Are you guys ready to record this whole thing all over again?
I didn't care for it. I didn't buy it.
That seems pretty ridiculous.
I don't even want to think about the possibility of you having your dick out.
Yikes.
Is this the most important thing in the universe? What happened to it? I don't know.
I needed to suck in absolutely every moment of awesomeness.
Yeah. Welcome back to another great episode of the Geek Legacy Podcast. Hope you're buckled in. This is going to be a fun one. Got a couple quick stories, and then we're going to do the listicle thing with a couple lists where I'm sure we'll have much debate. First off, David here with Randy and Justin. Randy, how you doing?
I'm fantastic. I can't wait to show you all my listicle.
Woohoo! Justin, are you interested to see Randy's listicle, and how are you doing?
I am, and I'm fabulous. Thank you.
Are you fabulous because you know you're only minutes away from Randy's listicle, or were you fabulous? Listicle.
Nope. I was down and out in Beverly Hills, and now I'm fabulous.
I'm going to drain my listicle all in your ear holes.
I like the sound. I like where this is going. Let's pause the listicle. We're going to go to quick little news bits here. Randy, I heard there was some developments on the Carrie Fisher gate. Disney's careful handling of Carrie Fisher's untimely death in Star Wars Episode 9. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This has been a big topic of debate for us over the last week or so. We were talking about, hey, what are they going to do? Are we going forward with Episode 9? Are we going to recast Carrie Fisher or Princess Leia, rather? Or are we going to is Disney going to CG her performance? A lot of people were just saying, yep, they're going to CG her just like they did for Rogue One, because she loved her character cameo in Rogue One, so everybody thought she'd be cool with it. Well, Disney came out and issued an official statement, or it wasn't Disney, it was Lucasfilm, which is under the Disney umbrella, but Lucasfilm came out and said that, look, we are not going to CG her in Episode 9, so please stop spreading those rumors. Basically, paraphrased, but yeah. So that means that they're going to have to rewrite the original storyline, because she was going to have a much larger role, as we mentioned last week, in Episode 9. So at least there's a little bit of clarification right out the bat. But that just means there's going to have to be some changes made, probably, in Episode 8, where they do have plenty of footage of her. Maybe we'll see her death.
Did you so reading into that, do you read into that that they also have no interest in recasting her as well? Did you get that from that little blurb?
That's kind of what I got. Mainly in as much as it said that she basically, Carrie Fisher will always be Princess Leia, and almost something to the effect of you can't imagine anybody else taking her place. She'll always be Princess Leia. So to me, that says that, look, we're not going to recast her. We're just going to find a way to kill her off.
Yeah. You think they'll kill her off? Well, I guess
they're going to have to.
Yeah. They can't really have her like right off in the sunset, like Paul Walker, I guess. It wouldn't really fit. Like, well, my son is terrorizing the universe and my ex-husband's dead. I'll just go hide. I'll pull a Luke and just go hide like a little, you know what? What do you think of these statements, Justin? And what does it say that the fervor of the internet was so great that Lucasfilm had to make an official announcement about something that was speculative?
I know, that's one of their things. They don't comment on rumors or speculation, so that's a pretty big deal. I don't know. I mean, I was on board with recasting, so, and I still am. I was trying to find the statement. I don't have it in front of me, and I wish I did.
I haven't.
Can you link it to me really quick?
Yeah, it's in our text chain. If you just scroll up, like, not that far, Randy texted it to us.
Oh, in our text chain on the telephone.
On your mobile device.
Yeah, now we're talking.
On the telephone.
Yeah. But where to say? Can I read it out loud really fast?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. So we don't normally respond to fan or press speculation, but there is a rumor circulating that we would like to address. We want to ensure our fans that Lucasfilm has no plans to digitally recreate Carrie Fisher's performance as Princess or General Leia Organa. Carrie Fisher was, is, and always will be part of the Lucasfilm family. She was our princess, our general, and more importantly, our friend. We are still hurting from her loss. We cherish her memory and legacy as Princess Leia, and we will always strive to honor everything she gave to Star Wars. So, when they say Carrie Fisher was, is, and always will be part of the Lucasfilm family, she was our princess, our general, and more importantly, our friend. Do you interpret that as she was, but we may have a new, or do you interpret that as cementing that Carrie Fisher will only and forever be Princess Leia?
I took it as the latter, just the tone of it. Just I think that they issued this release, and so it either means, because you know Colin Trevorrow, who's directing episode 9, he flew into Los Angeles to talk to Disney, to talk to Kathleen Kennedy and Lucasfilm, to come up with a plan. So it is possible that in a short period of time, I'm sure Billy Lord, her daughter, Carrie Fisher's daughter, was there. It is possible within a short amount of time they came to something that the family found respectful, that Lucasfilm and Disney both found respectable. I mean, it could be that they recast. I mean, they could have went to her daughter and said, this is a huge scene and we need it in this film. I mean, it doesn't specifically say it in
Little blurb. It says, we cherish her memory and legacy as Princess Leia, and we will always strive to honor everything she gave to Star Wars. So that last part leads me to believe that they will find a way to honor her role. You know, the legacy as Princess Leia, and will always strive to honor everything she gave to us, which is why I think that there is still a possibility that someone else can play it.
I hope you're right. I mean, I hate the idea of someone else playing Princess Leia or General Leia, but I, like we talked about last week, I think that the scenes that they had mapped out for her are just so pivotal and important to the emotional arc of this new trilogy, especially in regards to like the old guard, that without them, you know, it negates some of the punch that is Han Solo's death. But I mean, I could see it going either way. They could easily rewrite it, and now it's blank confronts Kylo Ren, you know. Maybe Chewbacca tears his arms off or something like that.
But, yeah. Or at least pulls his arms out of his sockets.
Yeah, like Ugar plot or whatever.
I mean, I don't know. I'm cool either way, but I think it would be like as a lifelong fan of the franchise, I in no way, shape, or form would be offended if they gave the role to another person so that Leia can have the arc that she deserves.
Yeah, and I mean, in this kind of Randy's point of, you know, killing her off, is that more disrespectful to her legacy? Like, if the original plan was not to kill off General Organa, is it just more disrespectful to the legacy of the character and, by extension, Carrie Fisher, to change it to hastily kill her off screen or kill her, you know, we see her from behind? If they're not going to digitally recreate her, you know, that limits how they can kill her off in this film.
Okay, so I think it's okay to kill her off if she was recasted. I think that a character like her would need to go out in the vein of Kirk in the beginning of Star Trek Generations, where he saved the entire ship. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
some sort of...
She needs to be like, on the bridge of a ship, just like ramming into something, like heroically throwing herself in front of a bullet, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, she doesn't run from danger. She runs towards it, as far as I'm concerned. So it would be silly to write her off in that regard. It's not some soap opera character where they just fired somebody because they were a dick on set. You know what I mean? It's more powerful than that.
Right. Or somehow her sacrifice needs to either redeem her son or lead to the direct defeat of Snoke, who took her son from her. Because, I mean, it all comes down to Snoke took her son took her husband. So because of Snoke, she basically lost everything. She lost her brother, she lost her son, she lost her husband. And I think that her story arc needs to be almost bigger than Ben. I think, yes, she needs to confront her. And I think an emotional scene would be a scene that almost parallels the Han Solo Kylo Ren thing, with Kylo not being able to do that to his mother. Like, there's something different between a son and his mother than a son and his father, especially if, you know, Kylo is the rebellious teenager, which I assume he was, to where he killed his father, maybe he can't kill his mother, and, like, maybe Snoke kills Leia in front of Kylo, and that's what leads to Kylo's pseudo-redemption, you know, to where he takes out Snoke and is killed in the process, because I don't think he's a fully redeemable character. but I'm just talking out my ass right now.
Because he killed Han Solo.
He killed Han Solo. there's no coming back from that.
You mentioned a relationship between a son and their mother. I'm just curious, when you guys were sick and you were kids, did you call your dad to pick you up from school, or did you call your mom to pick you up from school?
It was always mother.
Yeah, it was always my mom. And it's funny because my dad, like, I'd always go to my mom for stuff, but my dad is like the biggest softie and my mom's like the biggest ball buster. And then my mom would even tell me that. She's like, I don't know why you're not asking your dad. And like, your dad's like the biggest cream puff in the world. Why are you coming to me and stuff like that? But there was just something, like, you know, there's something in that maternal relationship. Hmm. And I'm just devastated that we're not going to see that fully realized, you know. The arc of the first trilogy was father and son. It would be a great backdoor sneak in here to where it was going to be daughter and son. And without recasting. Mother and son. Sorry. Without recasting, we're just not going to see that. And we would be cheated as Star Wars fans. It'll be something in a comic book or something like that. They'll have to do it in the expanded universe. And, you know, Carrie Fisher's better than that.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it's freaking interesting. Like, Rogue One, interesting?
Oh!
Yeah. Rogue One's about to pass $1 billion worldwide, and so everyone's coming out of the woodworks talking about how great a movie it was, and we're coming back to those reshoots, and one of the editors, John Gilroy, came out and said that Darth Vader scene at the end of the movie that we all know and love was added in those reshoots, that it wasn't part of principal photography. We don't know if that means it was never intended, or if they realized they were going to be doing pickups and that it fit better in the pickup schedule. You know, that sounds less likely than it was. We know for a fact that Gareth Edwards talked about that there was a draft, that some of which may have been shot, in which some of the rebels survived. And so the popular thought process now is that now that they all died, rather than end it on that bummer, sour note of everyone dies, we get this elative kick-ass scene of Darth Vader where everyone's stoked and happy, followed by Leia, to where we get like that glimmer of hope. So the movie ends on a high note.
Kind of funny that him killing rebels is a high note?
Yeah.
Like, the whole time you're rooting for the rebels, and it's like, yeah, and then all of a sudden, enter Darth Vader, and you're like, yeah, murder those motherfuckers!
I think it is because we know that it's just a fun scene. We know that he's not going to stop them. Mm-hmm. Like, we know that what he's doing there does not prohibit them from getting the plan, so I think we're able to enjoy it because we know. I think this is one of the rare instances to where knowing what happens actually makes something more enjoyable.
Yeah. I couldn't get over it.
Like Titanic.
Yes. Like Titanic. Oh, man. Did I tell you guys that I watched it was this documentary on the Titanic, and it was like the last, something to the effect of the last mystery of the Titanic as to why the distress call wasn't picked up. And it had something to do with when they were doing the Morse code, basically, with the lights flagging for signaling for help, the lights didn't look like the actual signal. Like when you're you're on a mountaintop and you're overlooking Las Vegas and the lights look like they're blinking, but they're not. It's the same concept. Because of the distance and the way that the air was, the lights have like this this sort of blinking effect. So they weren't even able. It just looked like some weird anomaly out in the middle of the ocean. It didn't look like somebody actually signaling for help. Isn't that kind of funny? Like you literally wouldn't be able to read the lights because they're blinking in the wrong sequence.
I also saw, speaking of the Titanic, I saw something on it to where they were saying that I guess there was an enormous fire in the Titanic, like before it left port, and that the temperature got so hot that that's what led to the actual iceberg being able to penetrate it, that had the metal not been weakened by this fire, that they could have hit that iceberg and they probably would have survived.
Really? I saw that they could have, if they would have hit the iceberg head on instead of moving away from it, they would have stayed afloat. Like, if they just would have smashed right into it, it would have been fine.
Clearly, the captain just sucks.
Well, it
ruins
everything. If a little bitty rabbit runs on the side of the road next to my car, I swerve the steering wheel. So, I mean, it's the same concept. It's just a reaction. You're like, oh, shit, got to get out of the way.
Yo, rabbit!
A bunny is hardly the same impact as an iceberg. Anyway, sorry. That just totally reminded me of it.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. Well, what do you think about this, Randy? Do you think, I mean, obviously it's a good addition because I think we all are pretty much in the camp that Vader scene is one of the best things in the history of Star Wars, but do you think that Vader and Leia softened the blow of having all of these heroes that we saw for 2 hours be systematically murdered?
Wow, when you say it like that. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's feeding into that sense of nostalgia. And I mean, from ever since we found out that there were going to be more Star Wars movies, before the prequels even, all we wanted to see was Darth Vader be a badass. Or at least that was all I wanted to see. So that wish was fulfilled for like 60 seconds on screen. And yeah.
He's kind of a badass in Episode 3.
Kind of. He has his moments.
He kills Wat Tambor off screen.
He kills all those separatists. the real badass part, though, is when the babies get slaughtered, all the little younglings.
Oh, why you gotta take it so dark? Why can't you mean?
It would have been cool if you'd have lifted them up and twirled them around like an aeroplane, and then just stuck his lightsaber up in the air and just cut them all up into pieces.
Just like they're spinning and he holds his lightsaber steady, like bringing them into it, and then you got like a spiral cut child kind of.
That'd be awful.
Yuck.
We'll save that for the Blu-ray.
Yeah, the Hollywood Reporter made a fun little comparison of, you know, killing all of the people in Rogue One. That it's an interesting choice for Disney, who doesn't typically like to kill their characters. And they say through 14 movies of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, only one Avenger has died. So, I guess Disney doesn't mind killing the Star Wars characters.
They do that.
Women do shop.
Well, in this particular movie, sacrifice was needed. So it's justified, obviously.
I agree. Do what must be done. That's from Episode 3, too. It's a good movie. You'd love it. Well, you know, Justin loves James Cameron. And James Cameron's going to do something cool, right, Justin?
James Cameron's speaking brother. Speaking of Titanic. Yeah, so AMC has greenlit a series of documentaries that James Cameron's going to work on that is basically telling the story of science fiction, how it's evolved over the years through pop culture. The series is going to debut in 2018. It's going to be 6 one-hour episodes. I'm actually really looking forward to this. I mean, just it's crazy how some of these pioneer thinkers just inspired so many people, like Jules Verne or H.G. Wells. You know, that's just fucking nuts. How I can't even imagine in the Wild Wild West and thinking about things like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I mean, I can't even put Legos together. I have zero imagination whatsoever. So I'm just blown away at some of these authors. I think that's so fucking cool, and I'm ridiculously jealous. So I'm an eager little beaver.
For Legos always turn into spaceships and guns.
Yeah. Mine.
No matter what they start as.
I can make a wicked foundation for any building.
Like, you could put a skyscraper on this son of a bitch.
Yeah, I'm terrible. But I'm really, really excited for this. Of course, there's all sorts of subgenres within science fiction. You know, there's like horror and super ultra-violent. And there's some that are tailored to kids, some that are more tailored to adults. There's obviously the social commentary. This is what our world will be like if we continue on this path kind of thing. And there's a lot to be learned from science fiction. And it's like, at what point does this fiction become fact? You know what I mean? It's crazy to think about. So, it's exciting stuff.
Yeah, it is exciting stuff. Nice. And when is it air?
Not till sometime in 2018.
I got to wait a long time.
He's got to finish Avatar 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 before it comes out.
Oof. It takes his time. It is a luxury afforded to filmmakers who have the two highest grossing films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
They'll let you take your time, I guess.
Yeah. He's on the George R.R. Martin camp of taking the time.
Well, nice. Well, cool. Like, I think we'll have to set our TV, our TiVos and our DVRs and whatever we have in 2018. That's sure. New.
I mean, honestly, it's one of those, science fiction is one of those, like art reflecting the times, you know, there, whether it be a nuclear, scares or, pollution, cloning, whatever. It's always the good stories are pretty topical for those generations. That's always exciting stuff.
Yeah. I agree. Well, cool. Well, I think now we're going to do something a little bit different because it's a slow news cycle, marked with the long holiday and with the big Nintendo Switch reveal. You know, we don't cover the video games. Justin and Steven will do that on the Pixelated podcast on Friday. So we thought we'd do a couple lists. And usually when we do lists, that leads to a lot of talking. And so in honor of Justin's amazing topic from James Cameron's science fiction documentaries, I got a list of 15 best science fiction movies of the 80s.
Ooh.
You guys excited?
Is RoboCop on this list?
I don't know. Yeah, you're going to have to wait. But you're not going to have to wait long for Randy to be excited, because at number 15, we have the granddaddy of all computer animation in films. We have The Mighty Tron from 1982.
All right.
Randy, tell me why Tron's so good.
For me, even back... Okay, the visual effects were groundbreaking for its day. The soundtrack was amazing also for its day. And, I mean, it's got the comic stylings of fucking the dude. So, come on.
Jeff Bridges.
Need I say more?
Okay. Well, apparently not.
My favorite part is still just when they're waiting for the door to open at the beginning.
That's a big door.
God, it's so funny. It just takes forever to open. And he even looks at her and smiles like, I know.
Yeah. It's going to be worth it, I swear.
But I think what it was, too, I mean, if you want me to elaborate on it a little bit more, it kind of played into a childhood fantasy that, like, what kid, you know, once you've spent a couple hours playing video games in your life, and, you know, when you're young in the 80s, you had to go to an arcade to do it, or you had some shitty console at home like the Atari or something like that. But, I mean, once you've spent some time doing it, I mean, isn't that some sort of fantasy of yours to be sucked into a video game? That's amazing. Mm. It's like two of your favorite things when you're growing up, when you're young. You know, movies and video games. All in one.
I like it.
John awesome. Ritter got sucked into a TV once.
And Stay Tuned, Jeffrey Jones.
Good shit.
Probably not on this list.
It was 90s anyway.
I actually paid good money to see that movie when it came out.
I saw the theaters. Number 14 is directed by James Cameron himself. It's 1989's The Abyss.
Ooh. Really?
Any Abyss fans in this group?
Yeah, but I mean, I prefer Aliens or Terminator 2, but that was 90-something, like 91, 92. Yeah.
Well, the cool thing is we wouldn't have the visual effects of Terminator 2 if it wasn't for that, you know, water spout in The Abyss, yeah.
That is true. Plus, right, the first Terminator was Cameron too, right?
Uh-huh.
Yep. Did you have you guys seen the Ultra Mega edition of The Abyss with the original ending?
Where it's like 3 hours long?
Yeah, it's like 3 hours long, and so the movie ends with when Ed Harris's character goes in to talk to the aliens, they're in the middle of about to destroy the Earth. They create this enormous tidal wave that's about to destroy like New York or whatever, and when Ed Harris goes in there, they like freeze it, and then Ed Harris saves the day.
Oh, that was very nice of him.
It was. Damn decent of him. Then he fucked it all up in Westworld, though.
Yeah, he's mean in that movie, in that show.
He's kind of a mean dude. He's the man in black. Number 13, I love to death, and I know Justin loves to death. I don't know where Randy stands on this. It's 1986's Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Randy, where do you stand on The Voyage Home?
I actually really like that movie.
It's amazing.
I love that so much. I mean, it's such a little wonderful 80s time capsule. I mean, it like literally pokes fun at itself in terms of like the pop culture of the day.
Yeah, and like Justin was saying about, you know, like social commentary, it's all about like, don't fuck up the planet because you never know what species you're killing might be your savior in the future. Mm-hmm. Admiral Darby Wales.
Oh, yeah, he's Admiral.
Yeah. He hasn't been demoted yet.
Yeah, at the end of the movie, right? Is when that happens?
Yeah, the end of part four, he gets demoted back to captain, which is what he secretly wanted.
Yeah, they're like, even though you saved the world, you're a piece of shit, we're going to demote you.
Yeah.
You're a loose cannon, a maverick. Can't have that.
Here's a starship, enjoy.
Yeah. We're going to give you another one, don't fuck this one up this time. It's so funny.
You blowed the other one up, and you stole a Klingon ship, and probably caused irrevocable war between our races, but you saved the world and brought us two humpback whales.
Yeah.
Bravo. George and Gracie. Number 12, I don't really think of it as a science fiction film, but I should, because the antagonist is an alien. 1987's Predator. Justin, ooh, you love Predator?
Love it.
Both. Would you consider this a science, like, I guess it is because it has the alien, but would you classify it as sci-fi, or would you make it more action?
Yeah, I'd say it's a sci-fi because of an alien coming and that hunts humans for sport. That strikes me as science fiction.
Is there a more testosterone filled film?
I don't think so.
You'd be hard pressed to
least,
find it.
At least not until The Expendables.
Yeah, that's true. This one has two governors in it.
Yeah. It's fucking badass, dude. I don't know if it gets much better than Predator as far as just awesome popcorn. People are dying, but you don't really care. It's fun. It's kind of scary. It's just neat. It's sort of that man versus nature kind of story, and I dig that.
Yeah, maybe that's it. It's a nice blend of genres. You know, it is a sci-fi film because it has the alien, but it at its core, it's just an awesome 80s. Like, it epitomizes like 80s action.
Mm-hmm.
It takes everything that's great about 80s action films and puts it with science fiction.
And the music's cool. The alien looks badass. Arnold looks like an itty-bitty man next to it. Like, it's just cool. I dig it.
And he says, get to the chopper.
Yeah, get to the chopper. And, Carl Edward... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Edward... Carl Weathers,
Carl Weathers, yeah. He's ripped. I mean, he's always been buff. Carl Weathers. I just watched all the Rocky movies last week, and man, that man was in good shape.
Yeah. What I was going to say was Schwarzenegger is now the host of The Celebrity Apprentice, and his line when you get kicked off is, you're terminated, but he also throws in a second line, and two times it's been, get to the choppa. And instead of leaving in a taxi cab like they did when Donald Trump hosted it, they go to the roof and an attack helicopter flies them away. It's as ridiculous as it sounds. Just like number 11, 1987's RoboCop.
Oh,
you guys love RoboCop. Tell me about it.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
What do you love about RoboCop, Justin? You were talking about it earlier.
The gratuitous violence. Mm. Like, Paul Verhoeven is just the Mac Daddy when it comes to over-the-top violence. And it is borderline off-putting. It's not for everybody. And it's just so crazy. And I love all the characters. Like, it's almost like a dystopian future, you know? Like, it is this world where humans don't have what it takes to beat evil anymore. We need a robot. We need a RoboCop to do our dirty work. And I just think that's fucking cool. I dig it.
Dick Jones.
Yeah, fucking Dick Jones. Bogomil from Beverly Hills Cop is just a mean son of a bitch. And you don't have to necessarily... And that teaches us something, too. That not all crooks are in the street. You know what I mean? Like, He was a bigwig at a powerful company, and he was just as terrible as the people that were murdering folks in the streets. He was murdering them in the offices, for crying out loud. The beginning
was
that
209.
Yeah, that poor bastard gets shot. He wins the award for most bullets taken into a body. That's terrible.
The N209 scared the shit out of me as a kid.
Oh, man.
I remember being terrified of that thing.
A lot of that movie terrified me.
Yeah, and when I watched it, I probably saw it as a kid. You know, it was, I was 8 when it came out. I probably saw it shortly after it came out. My parents were pretty liberal with what I could watch. And I didn't remember it being as violent as it was when I watched it like as like a late teenager or like early 20s. I'm like, holy shit, there's a lot of blood in this movie. It's pretty gratuitous.
If you watch the Criterion,
his hand shot off.
Oh, stuff. It's so gross. The Criterion Collection shows like an unrated version, like the original cut of the movie, and it was going to get an X rating, so they had to tone it down. Fun little fact.
I believe it.
Yeah, and it is awful. So even at the beginning when they shoot at the when Ed 209 shoots the executive, after he's dead and on the table, he doesn't even stop. He just keeps shooting him while he's on the table. It's fucking awful.
Like ground beef. That.
Oh man, my jaw dropped when I'd seen the movie 1,000 times already, and then when I watched that, it was too much. I was like, "Good lord, you were desecrating that body there. That is not cool."
Like, don't touch.
Yeah, don't touch. Holy shit, it was great.
Nice. Well, number 10 was Brazil by Terry Gilliam, and since we all hate Terry Gilliam and the movie Brazil, we'll just skip it, unless you guys love Terry Gilliam secretly.
Man.
Have you guys seen Brazil?
No, I haven't.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Randy's seen it. He loves it. Tell me about it.
Oh, I haven't seen
You love Terry Gilliam.
In ages. But I can say the only time I'm really kind of a fan of Terry Gilliam is whenever he's associated with Monty Python. That's about it.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. In breaking into the single digits with number 9, 1982's John Carpenter directed, starring Kurt Russell. Justin, what's this movie called?
Oh, well, wait. What year did you say?
1982.
Oh, okay, then that's a thing.
The Thing. Yeah, you're a big fan of The Thing.
Yeah.
All versions.
I just don't like the beginning when they're on the helicopter just shooting at the dog for like 5 minutes. I'm like, really, dude? This is the worst movie ever. And then when the dogs all transform and get all gross, ugh, that's some hardcore shit.
Ugh.
Don't like
it. Oh, me gusta.
I know, but Kurt Russell, this fucking guy in the 80s, you have The Thing, then there was Escape from New York, which is sci-fi. I mean, that is hardcore sci-fi with Manhattan being a prison. That's fucking badass. And then the best movie ever made, Big Trouble in Little China.
Best movie ever made?
Ever made, hands down, bar none. Big Trouble in Little China. Doesn't get any better than that.
That's a bold statement. I mean, I love that movie as well. I'm not...
It is true.
It's a bold statement.
best movie ever made.
Yeah, he had a pretty good 80s. He also had Tango and Cash in the 80s. He had Overboard in the 80s.
Oh, I love that movie.
Used Cars.
Used Cars, yeah, 1980, Used Cars.
Yeah.
Nice. That's
Kurt
pretty
Russell
good.
Is the 80s.
Kurt Russell's 80s resume is better than like 99% of Hollywood A-listers' whole career.
Yes. Agreed.
All right, number 8. We knew it would be on this. I'm surprised it's this low. It's 1984's Terminator.
Ooh.
Randy. Will he be? But he'll be back, and you loved it. Terminator?
I do love it.
Is it too low on the list?
Well, it depends, because I don't know what's going to be higher yet. So I think it's a good placement for it. I was always more of a fan of Terminator 2, and I know that's a 90s movie. But the first one's pretty badass. It's kind of scary. You know, it's kind of going back to that whole RoboCop thing. I mean, sci-fi movies in the 80s, they weren't fucking around. They weren't holding your hand and shooting kids out into space. Well, I guess they were with, like, Space Camp. But, I mean, they just took those movies seriously, and they were not afraid to curse, show lots of blood and titties.
Yeah, Terminator, it really made, like, I really got the impression there was nowhere to hide from this. Like, this thing was going to find you at sometime. Like, you know, other movies you could, like, get away or hide or something like that. Like, Terminator, I remember being one of the first movies I saw when I was younger that I just got the feeling there was no getting away from this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, it was him or you.
Especially it will not stop until you are dead.
And it does the voice of, like, her mom and everything. That's kind of...
Oh, wow.
That's kind of crazy. It's fooling.
Yeah.
Cheating.
Yeah, robots. You can't trust robots. Only good robot is a dead robot or a replicant. For number 7, 1982's Blade Runner. I'm surprised this isn't lower because everyone just jerks off all over the fucking face of Ridley Scott in his masterpiece of Blade Runner, which is okay. It's a fine film, but I don't get its iconic status. I think Randy's the one who holds this movie in highest regard, though.
Well, of the three of us, yeah, I probably would say that I hold it in the highest regard of us, but it's okay. It's fun. I like the visuals. I like the dystopian feel, of flying cars. I mean, come on. There's a lot of really cool elements to the aesthetic. It's basically like kind of like a 1940s detective noir kind of story set in the future. And how many other movies can you think of that had done that in the past? So I think it kind of was a successful mashup of genres that really spoke to a lot of people at the time. And again, it's kind of that dirty lived-in universe that the 80s gave us, because apparently we didn't have much of a positive outlook on the future in the 80s.
Yeah, and I think that goes to the whole thing of, I think sci-fi may be best when it's melding genres. You know, that straight hardcore sci-fi sometimes is hard to watch and off-putting, but you can have a sci-fi setting and a different genre. You know, like, I'm sure Empire Strikes Back will be on this list. You know, it's kind of a nice, you know, the Star Wars films are kind of a nice little melding of, like, Westerns and sci-fi and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know. Western, Blade Runner, do it. Speaking of movies that we don't really care for, this isn't on the list. Just kind of an aside, I watched Dune the other day. Like, I sat down to watch the whole thing just because, like, I'm like, you know what, maybe I need to give this movie another chance. No, that movie sucks. It's like a 2-hour exposition dump. In a bad way. Moving on. Number 6 is 1981's The Road Warrior. Mel Gibson is Mad Max. And, yeah.
RVD like, all over that one.
Yeah, Randy's a big post-apocalyptic kind of guy. He's our go-to post-apocalyptic
guy. Yeah. Seriously. Well, it goes back to what I love so much about the 80s action movies. It's just full of explosions, violence, blood, and titties. And it wasn't ashamed of what it was. It was just R-rated, in your face, we're going to fuck shit up out in the middle of the desert. And one of the things that frustrates me so much is the how it was, the franchise was completely neutered from that point forward. Beyond Thunderdome was PG-13, and then Fury Road, badass as it was also PG-13. It lacked that ultra violence that I dig about Road Warrior.
Fury Road is PG-13?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
I have to fact check that one. I did.
You might have to. I could be wrong, but
no, it's rated R.
Is it? Okay.
It is.
But still, it didn't feel as violent to me as Road Warrior. And that's kind of one of the things I like about that so much, is because it put you in kind of a terrifying world. Like, I wouldn't want to live in that world, because I would be in some great little bastion that has gas and water and everything else, and then they're going to come, you know, fucking kill all the dudes and rape all the women and make me watch, you know? I don't know why I don't fit in either of those
categories.
You make
words come alive, Randy.
No, it's terrible. That is a terrible environment that I would not want to live in. But I'll damn sure watch it on the big screen for a couple hours, and it'll make me feel better about the shitty world that I do live in, you know? Because at least it's not that shitty.
All right, moving along. Number 5. Now, there used to be a time before IMAX screenings and the explosion of the foreign film market where there was a little film by Steven Spielberg called E.T. the Extraterrestrial that was the undisputed box office king for 15 years until Star Wars dethroned it in 97 with the special editions. And, of course, Titanic later on in 97 went on to destroy everything. But I think E.T. is kind of this movie that was our generation's great triumph that kind of gets lost, is getting lost in the footnote of history because of all of these bigger films. Do you guys think that E.T. resonates today like it resonated with us, Justin?
I don't think so, no. I don't even know. I mean, I don't know. I couldn't say because I don't have kids to know if people still watch it. But, I mean, like, me personally, I still cry when he's all sick and white and dying. Like, it just, I feel like I just think of when I lost, like a doggy or a kitty cat or something like that. And that's the only way I can really relate to it. But I get so choked up every single time. And it's a beautiful story. And I have no idea if it resonates with audiences today. I feel like it doesn't come up in conversation unless it's us.
Right. I mean, because kids nowadays aren't going out and having adventures like they did in these great 80s movies with kids, you know, be it The Goonies or E.T. or Explorers, things like that. Kids just aren't doing that anymore.
I know. And like when we were talking Stranger Things, you know, these kids are very young and they're riding their bikes at, you know, after dark. And I totally did that with my friends. It wasn't, I mean, I would eat dinner as fast as I could so I could go back outside. Like, that was, like, how I did things. And it's just weird to think that, you know, we're in this era where we don't even trick-or-treat anymore without parents. And kids go to Target or they go to the mall to trick-or-treat. That was, like, the one night where you're able to go out and just, like, be a kid and not really worry about shit. Stranger danger does not apply. You knock on as many doors as you want. And you say, give me the candy, man. And it's just crazy that it's.
And you go into those haunted houses.
Yeah. You are looking at death in the face and you don't give a shit. You just want your candy bar. And if some asshole has the audacity to give you like a nickel and three pennies, you're just like, you motherfucker.
I got an egg with your name on it later.
Yeah. And that's just part of growing up. It's a critical time in the development phase. It teaches a kid independence. Or not to fear. It's great.
All those overprotective parents ruining sci-fi movies of the modern age.
Yeah, but I mean, E.T. was very much that. You know, I had a bike gang. There was five of us. We all had our bikes, and we rode everywhere together. That's what we did. I
terrorizing the old folks in the neighborhood.
Yeah, one time, I remember we found, there was these two giant trees out in the middle of the desert, and we would go there, and one time we found this blanket stuffed into the trunk of this tree, and we removed the blanket. There was needles of sorts, and then there were porno mags. We grabbed like 30 of these porno mags, and we just started putting them in people's cars in the neighborhood because it was a desert. Everyone had their windows down, so we were just throwing porn mags in everybody's cars in the neighborhood.
You started throwing needles at each other.
And we didn't touch the needles. We were smart enough, thank God, to not deal with the needles.
That's good.
Holy shit, that's just kids being kids, man. Every child should get in trouble in some way. That's just part of growing up. Be bad. Don't hurt anybody, but just do kid shit.
Yeah. Don't torture animals or do like witchcraft, but you know, go out and skin your knees and raise a little bit of hell.
Get hurt.
Maybe a moderate level of hell.
Yeah, break a bone. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Break a bone, suck a dick.
Whatever.
You'll figure it out.
2016, 2017, you know. All right, moving on. Number four, maybe the perfect movie. You know, never have I heard a bad word said about 1985's Back to the Future. Ooh. It's a special movie for, I think, everyone of our time frame. I remember anytime it was on TV, you had to watch it. I remember taking my grandma to see this movie and just loving the shit out of it. And Randy's even got a DeLorean on his desk that some kid ruined.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a DeLorean missing. It's Mr. Fusion. Thank you very much.
How's it going to go back in time, Randy, without Mr. Fusion?
I don't know. I've been trying to figure that out.
You basically kept it.
Yeah. It is quite possibly the best movie ever made. Just from a screenplay standpoint, it's practically perfect. It's got everything that you want to see in a movie. It's got adventure, humor, love story, and it's just so it's something that you can enjoy with your whole family and not have to feel weird or awkward about. And that's something that a lot of those movies on this list you can't necessarily say, you know, like I couldn't say that about RoboCop or The Terminator, you know, watching a scary movie. But this is just great, just good old family fun.
And nobody doesn't like it.
Pretty much.
Like, I mean, there are people out there who hate Empire Strikes Back or hate Aliens or who hate all these other great iconic movies that you wouldn't think anybody hates, but nobody hates. No one has a bad thing to say about the first Back to the Future. I don't think I'm bringing the same treatment out of Justin on number three as I sit here staring at my autographed picture of Ricardo Montalban. Number three, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, the greatest Star Trek film ever. Justin,
I'll take the remake into darkness.
You get my vomit bag, yeah.
I don't do it, man. Star Trek II just doesn't do it for me. I don't like it.
That's fine. It's surprising because it's like the shortest Star Trek movie.
I know.
It's like 20 minutes long.
I still don't like it. I don't like him on that planet. I don't like that dumb little ship that just destroys the Enterprise, the Reliant. I don't like his abs. I don't like the movie.
I don't think we see his abs. We see his muscular chest.
Whatever. His pecs.
So buff.
Yeah. I'm not into it at all. And then, who's the young woman in it? Is it Kirstie Alley? Is she in that one?
Yeah, she plays Mr. Savick.
Yes. I don't like that. She bugs.
Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah, and Montalban and Shatner never share a set together. All of their communication is done through communicators and screens.
Through Skype, yeah.
Yeah. Before we knew what Skype was, Khan was using it. Mm-hmm. All right, if I got to let you down with number three, number two will pick your spirits back up. Number two, 1986's James Cameron appears on this list again for Aliens. I think this is his fourth appearance on this list. James Cameron is the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Aliens, dude, that's a fucking amazing movie. Our buddy, is it? Yeah, you don't like it?
Oh, no. I was going to say a sentence, but I didn't want to interrupt you. I was going to say, is it better than the original?
Ooh, it's two very different movies.
I
think it's more enjoyable, but Alien is more of a scary sci-fi movie, whereas Aliens is, I would say, is more on the lines of Predator, where it's a little bit more fun.
Yeah, it's definitely more rewatchable.
Mm-hmm.
More Aliens, more fun.
Yeah.
More Aliens, more fun.
But bigger crew, bigger weapons, a bunch of aliens, not just the one. It's intense. And you got the queen. Holy shit, the queen alien. When it was all laying its eggs, how gross was that?
It's got the mucus.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Let me pose this question to both of you. Do you think that James Cameron gets the respect he deserves as a filmmaker? Let me read you quick his IMDb, his movies. The Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, Terminator 2, True Lies, Titanic, and Avatar. Do you think this man's getting that's a pretty impressive filmography. But I don't really ever... I mean, you hear him like, I like James Cameron, but do you think he gets the credit he deserves?
Are those the only movies on his IMDb?
Yes.
I mean, he doesn't have a thick stack of movies, but what he does have is long?
Is long?
Well, he lacks in girth, he makes up for in length.
I mean, you could argue the worst movie on this list is The Abyss, which is still not a bad movie.
Yeah, no, all of those movies, I mean, any single filmmaker could die happy had they made one of those movies. Any one of those could be in some way considered a masterpiece. So I think, I don't think he's overrated at all. I think he deserves to wear that crown. It's not just about making a shit ton of money, which he has, which his movies have, but I think every single one of those is actually good and watchable.
Mm-hmm. But do you think he's properly rated? Like, you know, when you see on these lists, you know, about top directors and stuff like that, like, I don't ever really hear James Cameron's name, and I mean, or is it just because he makes fun movies and no one takes him serious?
Right, so he does make really fun movies, and you know, with the exception of the 80s, he has large gaps in between his films. You know, Titanic was, what, 97? And mm-hmm. then his next big one was Avatar in 2009. That's a significant gap. And both movies brought in billions of dollars. That's incredible. But I mean, all of his movies are fun. They're staples in pop culture. Terminator, Aliens, fucking True Lies. That True Lies is one of the most fun action movies of the 90s, dude. That movie is hysterical. And I don't know, man. I think people just kind of forget about him. Not necessarily. It's
because he's not churning out a movie every year.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. He takes his time and does what he's got to do. But I mean, he's in the grand scheme of things, almost every single movie that he has made is on a list of favorites for me. So I mean, that's incredible. And I'm like Randy. I hate everything, but I love James Cameron.
Nice. Well, you don't hate. I'm sure you don't hate number one, The Empire Strikes Back, 1980. What else could it have possibly been?
Where the hell?
The greatest.
Why is Return of the Jedi?
I don't know. I guess they decided that they could have two Star Treks and, but not
every
two,
James Cameron
Star Wars
movie, yeah. but not Return of the Jedi.
Let's see, author Jim Cameron. Oh wait, now we know.
No. Do you think that should be number one on this list?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
No.
I think for Empire Strikes Back should probably be the best science fiction movie of all time. So it's pretty amazing. I mean, like we were talking about Back to the Future, you know, it's a sequels nowadays are so formulaic, you know, it's take what you did in the first one and then just make everything bigger, the explosions more, to where Empire kind of went the other way. It got smaller, you know, it became a smaller, more personal scale, and it was a completely different movie than its predecessor, and that's just not something that you typically get in these big sequels, and I think for that reason alone, it deserves to be on the top of this list. But that's my list. I'm sure if anyone's listened to any episode of the podcast, I'm sure you can guess our feelings on The Great Empire Strikes Back. So yeah. We don't need to hash out how amazing it is and how perfect it is. So it's going to be a double dose of listicles. Randy had promised to put listicles in our ears, in our mouth, and up our nose. So, Randy, what do you got going on?
All right, we move from the right listicle to the left listicle. My list is the 10 insane sequels that were almost released, starring Nick Cage. Just kidding on the Nick Cage part. In fact, I think he's probably absent from this list, I believe. But number 10 here is aimed directly at Justin. Batman Unchained.
Ooh.
That was going to be the next Schumacher Batman movie with Clooney.
Ooh.
Was it like Batman Triumphant or Triumph or something? Unchained.
It says Batman Unchained.
All right. Let's hear it. Give us the log line.
All right. Schumacher's ideas of what fans want are a little strange. He planned to pit Batman against Nick Cage as the Scarecrow. I guess it did have Nick Cage in it.
Are you serious?
With Courtney Love playing Harley Quinn.
Do you only go to Nick Cage websites, Randy?
But the catch in this one is Harley Quinn would find out that the Joker is her father.
What?
Was Jack, is it Jack Nicholson Joker?
It doesn't say.
Oh, actually, no. It was, because they were trying to get Jack Nicholson to do flashbacks.
Really?
In this, but yeah. So when I, the synopsis that I read was Batman is like Triumph or Triumphant or something like that. Yeah, they were going to back a dump truck full of money up to the Jack Nicholson estate so that he would appear in what they estimated would amount to about 10 minutes of screen time, and he was going to appear in the flashbacks of this film.
It sounds like we would have seen Schwarzenegger's Mr. Freeze again in the form of hallucinations, because we are dealing with the Scarecrow after all.
But Batman's not afraid of Freeze.
Yeah.
He's not.
He's got enough.
I honestly think it would just be an excuse to trot out all of the villains that they have access to.
There you go.
Okay, so next one on the list, number 9, Lord of the Rings 2.
They didn't have Lord of the Rings.
Tolkien very nearly wrote a sequel to Lord of the Rings. He even sat down and wrote 13 pages of it before he realized what he was doing and threw it in the trash. This is according to the article here, which I don't know how much truth there is to that. It was going to be set 100 years after the end of the original and didn't really have very many hobbits in it. Instead, Tolkien opened up with a riveting scene in which two men sit and have a philosophical discussion about the waste of natural resources and whether deforestation serves a beneficial purpose. Wow.
Is this Lord of the Rings 2?
Lord of the Rings 2. In Tolkien's own words, he said it would have been sinister and depressing. Not worth doing, ultimately, he said.
Like the Hobbit movies.
Touche, my friend, touche. Number 8 on our list was also on your list, E.T., but this one's part 2, Nocturnal Fears. Yeah.
Was Steven Spielberg involved in this? Terrible idea?
After the smash success of Steven Spielberg's touching story about the beautiful friendship between a child and a friendly alien, studios were clamoring for a sequel, and Spielberg almost gave them one. He wrote a 10-page proposal called E.T. 2, Nocturnal Fears. It was darker than the original, a lot darker. In the sequel, evil aliens with razor-sharp teeth come to Earth looking for E.T., who this movie reveals really has the absolutely awful sci-fi name of Zrek. Z-R-E-K, Zrek. The evil aliens capture Elliot and his friends and torture them. Eventually, Elliot gets so brutally tormented that he cries out for E.T. to help. Not with a phone or anything, he just starts sobbing, and E.T. comes to the rescue.
I got nothing.
Yeah.
that sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, I won't even... There's more plot breakdown, but I'm not even going to go into it.
Oh, there's more?
There's more.
All right.
So, number 7. Toy Story 3. Toy Story in Taiwan. This is before the original Toy Story 3 that we actually ended up getting. But when Disney and Pixar split up, Disney kept the rights to all of Pixar's movies, and Disney was feeling vengeful. They decided that with or without Pixar, they were going to do sequels to Pixar movies anyway. Disney even set up a whole studio called Circle 7 to make them. Helmed by the team behind the classic direct-to-DVD movies like The Lion King 1.5, Disney went to work making a Toy Story 3 that the world never saw. The first pitch was to make a whodunit mystery about the one that got passed over for another idea. They were going to bring the toys to Taiwan. In this story, Buzz Lightyear would be recalled and sent to Taiwan, and the other toys would have to rally together to save him. They ultimately had to perform surgery on Buzz Lightyear.
I like the idea of Disney just so mad at Pixar. They're like, I'm going to fuck your franchise.
Yeah, we're just going to tank this thing.
Just out of spite.
That's so sad.
You just see the board meeting of fucking like Eisner just pissed. Like, fuck this John Lasseter guy. He thinks he can do this to me? Fuck it. What's he got, Toy Story? Let's run this motherfucker into the ground. And then he eats a live mouse.
I think... God, when did he leave? He was there until 2005, it says on.
Yeah, he was there a while, because Bob Iger succeeded him. Bob Iger's only been there for like 10 years.
Huh. I remember he sold a shit ton of stock like in like 97 or something like that. And
yeah.
Made quite a fortune.
I'm sure it's worth a lot more now, but he wish he kept down to that.
Yeah.
It's probably all backdated stock. Do you know they could do that? Like you can backdate stock for certain level executives and corporations. So, like, say the stock is worth $1,000 now, but 2 years ago it was worth $20. They can buy the stock for the $20 price. And then they can, and so it's that's when you get into like the legalities. But you're technically not supposed to sell it for X amount of time. Mm-hmm. So what some people do is they buy it for that cheaper price, and then through like, you know, intermediaries or like dummy corporations, they dump off it at the current price. Sorry, that was just a little fun thing I learned, but I guess no. Sorry, Randy.
Next on our list, number 6.
I know we're terrible, Randy.
That's all right. I just take little naps while you guys go off on a tangent, and I wake up and I hear my name. I'm like, oh, oh shit, I gotta talk again.
Talking about belt. Talking from Buzz Lightyear to Disney stock. Love it.
Nothing wrong with that. I love it. We get educated during this podcast. It's wonderful. All right, number six, Forrest Gump 2, Gump and Company.
Shit. There was a book.
Actually a book. Yeah, there was actually a book with a sequel, and the sequel was called Gump and Company. And we very nearly saw that sequel on the screen. But it would have been kind of weird, because Forrest Gump would have been a single dad after the death of his beloved Jenny. But she would be a ghost that comes back, follows him around, and acts as his guardian angel. We would find Forrest working at a strip club as a janitor for a while. Then he gets promoted to being a... NFL player, and then an astronaut. Yeah. And it would have culminated with him fighting in Operation Desert Storm. Alongside the orangutan that accompanied him into space.
Yes. Did I tell you that I read the first Forrest Gump book recently? Like, I saw like a description. I'm like, this is just too bad shit crazy. So... At one point in Forrest Gump, he goes into space. He's not an astronaut. He's an astronaut, the second one. But he inadvertently ends up in space. And when his shuttle crash lands, it crash lands into, like, the Amazon or some – I don't know if it was the Amazon. Anyways, and he ends up living with a group of cannibals for a number of years. It's very bizarre. And he's, like, mean. He's, like, racist. He uses, like, the N-word a couple times.
Huh.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think Bubba's going to like that.
He was from Alabama.
He was, that's true.
I'm just saying, in the South, they carry grudges.
Well, they still find that's the war.
I don't mean to generalize that all people in the South do that, I'm just saying.
You do declare.
I do declare. I'll refer to our resident Southerner, our Southern gentleman over there. Colonel Justin Cavender.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. All I can say is it's a good damn thing that videos disappear on Periscope after 24 hours. Otherwise, we would have had some damning evidence from a couple Comic Cons ago.
You can ravage. You can. What is it? You can burn our lands. You can ravage our bodies.
You can murder my family. You can ravage my body, but please. Don't destroy my plantation. Oh, Teen Wolf.
Yeah, Teen Wolf wasn't on the best sci-fi movies.
So good.
It's more horror than sci-fi. It's not even really horror, but more like creature kind of movie.
What about Teen Wolf 2? Jason Bateman.
Yeah.
And boxing.
Yeah, he boxed instead of playing basketball.
All right, number five on our list. This one we can all get a kick out of. Star Wars, Splinter of the Mind's Eye. And this is based off of a book written by Alan Dean Foster, which I believe came out in 79. It could be 78, but this was the very first piece of... it was like the first long-form Star Wars story that was released after the original movie, A New Hope. And apparently for a hot minute, they were thinking about making it into a movie. But it was kind of weird, and it kind of furthered the love story between Luke and Leia. They got stranded on the planet together, and they had a joint confrontation with Darth Vader, in which I believe Leia had to pick up Luke's lightsaber and kind of, like, while he was incapacitated. But the cool thing about that book, and I may have mentioned it on the podcast before, but it was the very first time that any mention was made in the Star Wars universe about Kyber crystals. But this wasn't... At this time, it wasn't described as, like, the crystal that was inside the lightsaber or any kind of great power source. It was more of, like, a mystical talisman kind of thing that enhances force power. Like, if you already had use of the force and you had this kyber crystal, it would be, like, a supercharged battery to give you an even better mastery of the force, was how I recall. And it's been – I haven't read that book in probably 20 years, but – But I did, for a book report in high school, make like a 15-minute video of Splinter of the Mind's Eye where I myself played Luke. It was kind of cool. So I have a little bit of a better memory of it than the average person who'd only read it once 20 years ago. But pretty glad to say, though, that it didn't get made into a movie because it didn't have Han Solo or Chewie in it. And it didn't have like any kind of big Imperial force. And the only time you saw any Imperial whatsoever was Vader. Yeah, it wouldn't have been a very cinematic movie.
Yeah, it's a very important piece of literature because it's what spurned Lucas into it. Because it was kind of the first piece of merchandising that Lucas didn't approve of. You know, 20th Century Fox took the license it out to Bantam Books, Del Rey Books. And they wrote this book without consulting with Lucas, and Lucas was very upset with it. This was what kind of spurned his negotiating with 20th Century Fox that he would maintain more creative control, especially in regards to like sequels. Because he was very displeased that it was very. If you were to read this book, you would assume that Luke and Leia would eventually get together. You know, Leia ends up like Randy was saying with the Kyber crystal, she ends up in possession with it because of the heightened ability she is granted. She's able to fend off Darth Vader. So you people bitching about Rey fighting Kylo Ren, I can only imagine if Princess Leia picked up Luke's lightsaber and had a convincing lightsaber battle with Darth Vader, that people would probably bitch back then as well.
Well, the thing about that though is, at that point we'd only had one Star Wars movie. Whereas by the time The Force Awakens came out, we had six movies to drill into our skull that only Jedi can wield lightsabers and only those who have been trained can do it well. So it may have been a little bit of an easier pill to swallow back then. Yeah. But I totally hear what you're saying.
And at one point, Luke has a scene with Darth Vader, where Darth Vader is like inspecting these miners that are because the Imperial are the ones looking for the Kyber crystal, and he like stumbles across Luke and checks his hands to like see if his story, because he's saying, "Oh, I'm a farmer." So he looks at his hands, and of course they're all rugged and stuff like that. So he believes him. I wish I was making it up. You were saying, Justin? I'm sorry.
I wasn't saying anything.
No.
I don't think. For once.
Oh, I thought you were gonna ask. It sounded like you were asking a question.
Oh, maybe. I doubt it was important.
Much like Splinter in the Mind's
Eye. It was something about Star Wars, but it doesn't matter anymore. The point is moot. Oh! I just remembered. But again, it doesn't even matter anymore. But I do remember what the question was.
I will gladly answer your question, or Randy
will,
I'm sure.
I mean, I just feel like it seems a little bit silly that everyone knows how to use a lightsaber in Force Awakens or at least they wield it very well. When there's no room for error with a lightsaber. If you touch something, it's gonna hurt it. You know what I mean? So like if you accidentally hit there, like when you're twirling around, you gotta practice with something like that. So I don't know. It just seems silly to me that Finn was able to be as good as he was with it. I don't know.
Yeah, Finn bothers me more than Rey, because Rey has her staff and we've established that she's a badass wielding the staff. So translating that to a lightsaber seems a little bit more natural to me. But yeah, Finn is what gets me, unless he was trained on one of those like shock stick things like the traitor trooper was fighting him with. Mm-hmm. You know, if he had some sort of training with that, then maybe I can understand his being able to wield a sword. But yeah,
that was a laser sword.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not the end of the world. It was just one of those things where I thought you had to be somewhat amazing to be able to pull it off, and it just it left me with the impression that any asshole can just hit the little button and be amazing with it. That's all.
Speaking of which, I will also point out that in Rey's final duel with Kylo Ren on Starkiller Base, when she first gets her hands on the lightsaber and ignites it, she is nowhere near the actual ignition switch for it. So, I mean, from an actual technical standpoint, there's no way she should have been able to turn that on because her fingers are in the wrong place. But that's just a little, that's a small little like continuity gaffe kind of thing.
She used the Force, Randy?
Yeah. Sorry, I geeked out a little too hard there. I'll continue on our list. Down to number four, Mrs. Doubtfire 2.
I'm in.
It's a movie that wasn't really begging for a sequel, but we almost got one anyway. Not many details had come out about the original sequel that they wanted to do, but even Robin Williams himself said it doesn't work, because at the end of the first movie they reveal who Mrs. Doubtfire is. So it was kind of squashed right then and there. However, just before his death, he had actually signed on for a sequel that actually had a completely different plot, but it was quote-unquote the perfect story. However, it has been released in tabloids, kind of what the, I don't know if any details about what the story was, but it basically said that it actually wasn't that good. He was just desperate enough for the cash to agree to do it, which is sad.
That is sad. But I think I know what your number one is. We're not there yet, though.
Yeah, we still got a couple movies to go. Number three, Space Jam 2. I never saw the original, so I was never one of those people that was like really into it, but I know a lot of people love that movie.
Pretty good.
You haven't seen the first Space Jam, Randy?
No, I haven't. But the second one would have been about Tiger Woods playing golf with Bugs Bunny in space.
Oh, shit. Sounds about right.
And then there was that April Fool's joke of Space Jam 2 with LeBron James.
Yeah.
And then everyone like picked up on it, and then they were like, maybe we will make it a thing, but I think they've since officially decided not to.
Yeah, I think so.
You should see Space Jam then, Randy. It's pretty good. It's on Netflix.
Now, this one caught me off guard because I was not expecting anybody to even acknowledge the first movie's existence. Number two is Super Mario Brothers 2. I've never seen the movie, but apparently, according to this article, the first one ends in a cliffhanger. Did you guys see it?
Yeah. You haven't seen the Super... By the way, every episode it ends with... with somewhere in the episode, it was me being incredulous, like, Rand, you haven't seen Blink? Every episode. I don't know why I keep doing it.
So at the end, Daisy bursts into the room calling to Mario and Luigi, you gotta come with me, I need your help. And it was supposed to get audiences on the edge of their seat begging for more, and instead, more never came. The girls never came.
What's good about the original Super Mario Brothers is that Luigi gets the princess in this one.
Oh, shit. Well, because he's young.
Have you seen it, Justin?
Yeah.
See, what you see here, Randy, is that King Bowser was Dennis Hopper, and he's in a land of dinosaurs that have evolved into people, to where we're a land of apes that have evolved into people. And then Dennis Hopper's Bowser goes to our land, and he has the de-evolution gun, so he starts shooting people and turning them into monkeys. And then he goes back to dinosaur land, and they shoot him, and he turns into a T-Rex, but there's a ba-bomb, and they blow him up. It's magic, Randy, it's magic.
Oh, sounds terrible.
It is terrible.
So much so that Nintendo never wanted to make another movie ever again.
It's pretty bad. It's like the people who made this had never even heard of Mario Brothers, I think.
Yeah.
Like the Goombas were like 6 foot tall, like tiny head people. And the Ba-bombs were Reeboks.
Yeah, we haven't heard anything about that Legend of Zelda Netflix series in like 2 years.
Didn't it come out as a hoax, or not a hoax, but like someone jumped the gun and then they didn't really have the green light or some nonsense.
Maybe.
Sad.
That is sad.
Number one on this list, I guarantee neither of you are going to get. But I will. I will.
We've talked about.
I don't know. I don't know if we have. I will give you all the change out of my pocket if you guess it correctly.
Is it Beetlejuice 2 when he goes to Hawaii?
Let's treat this as somewhat of a game. David, is that your guess, Beetlejuice 2?
Yeah.
All right, Justin, do you have a guess?
I don't.
Well, pick something. you might win like 97 cents here. Come on.
Okay. Big Trouble in Little China 2.
No, although that would have been fantastic. No, this one is Gladiator 2.
What? It's not Beetlejuice 2? This is false.
Gladiator? he dies.
Gladiator.
Spoiler
alert. Yeah. that would make a sequel a little tricky. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Would like the same team was going to be back?
So
Ridley Scott and all them?
No, the creators decided to hire Nick Cave, the rock star from the 1980s, to write the movie for reasons that nobody can quite explain. And the movie they came up with was pretty insane. So Cave's movie started with Maximus in the afterlife, now dead. He only wants to be reunited with his wife in the afterlife, so he goes in pursuit of her. Instead, he meets Roman gods who send him on a mission to stop the spread of monotheism. Soon he's brought back to life in the body of a dying Christian.
This idea is terrible.
Yeah.
Wow.
At the end of the movie, he inexplicably teleports through time, becomes a crusader, then fights in World War II, then fights in Vietnam. It sounds like the beginning, the opening sequence of the first Wolverine movie.
They just recycled it.
Totally.
See if that Nick Cave guy was involved in writing that one, too.
Shit.
But anyway.
And Gavin Hood wrote and directed.
Yeah. The whole plot thread of trying to find his wife gets dropped after the first, 10 minutes of the movie. And he's too busy traveling through time with his ghost buddies to even remember she exists. But anyway, that's the conclusion of my list. And that's both of our listicles for this week.
I'm shocked that it wasn't Beetlejuice 2 Hawaii. Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Yeah.
This summer he's putting the owl in luau. We talked about that a couple times.
We have.
I feel dumb that it wasn't that.
But we always have the animated Beetlejuice series to fall back on if a sequel never happens.
Which isn't terrible. It's not the worst thing. But cool. You guys got anything else? Anything fun you want to add? Will be you, Randy.
All right.
Well, next week we promise that if there's not good geek news, we'll go out and make it. We'll go out and find people and make the news, TMZ style, probably, sex scandals and drug overdoses and whatnot. So yeah. On that light note, make sure you listen to the other podcast in the Geek Legacy Network. You got the Comic Corner podcast with Tyler and Jeff, where they're talking about all those funny books. And the Pixelated Podcast, which hits on Fridays, where they're probably going to talk about Nintendo Switch. That's with Justin and Steven, where they talk about video games. And with all the Switch information, I'm sure there'll be some fun stuff to chat about. Make sure to like us on Facebook and Twitter at Geek Legacy. And go to geeklegacy.com for all your geek news and reviews. See ya!